Welcome to New World Notes. I'm Kenneth Doust. Who killed John Fitzgerald Kennedy? Look, I don't know the names of the exact combination of individuals, but I've come to agree with researchers including Gore Vidal, Michael Parenti, George Michael Ivica, and Jim Douglas, whose voice we'll hear again in this half hour. I believe that Kennedy was killed by high-ranking officials of the U.S. National Security State, so-called. I wouldn't be surprised to learn that Alan W. Dulles was a ringleader. Dulles was the long-term and extremely powerful head of the CIA until Kennedy fired him in 1961. Nor would I be surprised if some or all of the military heads, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, were ringleaders. And certainly a few captains of finance and defense industries. I'm not excluding Lee Harvey Oswald, by the way. Every good plot needs a fall guy. The psychological comfort, social status, career prospects, and personal fortunes of these men depended on perpetual enmity with the Soviet Union. And Kennedy's damned steps towards lasting world peace threatened to destroy all that they had achieved. But let's hear it from people more knowledgeable than me. We'll hear some more from Jim Douglas explaining the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba, Kennedy's secret correspondence with Premier Khrushchev of the Soviet Union, and the Cuban Missile Crisis. The missile crisis was when the United States discovered Soviet missile bases in nearby Cuba. This crisis brought us to the very, very brink of World War III. The National Security State desperately wanted this war, which they expected the United States would, quote, win, unquote. With surprising help from Soviet Premier Khrushchev, Kennedy was narrowly able to avert this much-desired war. This experience frightened the bejesus out of Kennedy, greatly accelerated his conversion, which had already begun, to a crusader for peace, and led directly to his greatest speech at the American University in June 1963. Here he became, I think, the only U.S. president ever to champion disarmament and to announce concrete steps he was taking towards this goal. And here he became a dead man walking, though not for long. It's a wonderful and frightening story, and Jim Douglas tells it well indeed. After Douglas, we'll hear more of Kennedy's great speech at AU. From that alone, you'll see why he had to die. Jim Douglas begins his story by discussing how the Kennedy of 1960 and 61 looked to theologian Thomas Merton.
Merton didn't think Kennedy was up to his task, and I think he was right. In the initial phases of the presidency, Kennedy, of course, allowed the Bay of Pigs invasion to occur. It was prepared by the CIA under Eisenhower, but Kennedy allowed it to go forward. And at that time, and in the months after it, Merton wrote this letter in which he said, "I have little confidence in Kennedy. I think he cannot fully measure up to the magnitude of his task. He lacks creative imagination and the deeper kind of sensitivity that is needed. Too much the time and life mentality," referring to the Henry Luce publications, "than which," Merton says, "I can imagine nothing further in reality from, say, Lincoln. What is needed is really not shrewdness or craft, but what the politicians don't have, depth, humanity, and a certain totality of self-forgetfulness and compassion, not just for individuals, but for humanity as a whole, a deeper kind of dedication. Maybe Kennedy will break through into that someday by miracle, but such people are before long marked out for assassination." I think Merton understood both Kennedy's limitations and his faults as he moved into his tasks as president, and he also understood prophetically exactly what needed to happen. He was praying for it to happen, for Kennedy to, as Merton put it, break through into that kind of deeper and wider humanity by miracle, and he also understood the consequence. He would be marked out for assassination. In the first major crisis of Kennedy's foreign policy, he consented to the invasion by Cuban exiles trained and controlled by the CIA at the Bay of Pigs in Cuba. That, he felt, in retrospect, was a manipulation by the CIA. They had lied to him. They had said that if the exiles landed at the Bay of Pigs, that there would be an uprising on the part of the Cuban people, that the Cuban people were so profoundly opposed to the revolution that they would overthrow Fidel Castro. Well, CIA knew that wasn't the case, and Kennedy was skeptical too, but he thought, well, their intelligence was something he had to rely on. But secondly, they also said that if the exile force, when it landed, got into military trouble, they could go into the mountains and do the same thing that Fidel Castro and the revolutionary group that he was working with had done. Well, there was no access to that kind of terrain at the Bay of Pigs. They were lying to him. And the reason they were lying to Kennedy was that he had drawn a line. He had said, I will not under any circumstances send in U.S. troops to Cuba. No combat troops. I'm not going to do that, no matter what happens. And they felt that by putting this young, inexperienced president in a situation where the Cuban forces were going to win, that he would have to send in heavy bombing and he would have to send in the troops who were in U.S. ships off the coast of Cuba. Kennedy said, no, I won't do it. And he took the defeat at the Bay of Pigs rather than up the ante as the CIA and the Joint Chiefs thought he would have to. He not only did that, but he was infuriated by what had happened and the manipulation by the CIA and the Joint Chiefs. And he said, I want to splinter the CIA in 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds. And he then fired Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA, a man who of enormous power, the brother to John Foster Dulles. The two of them had controlled foreign policy in the United States government during the 1950s under Eisenhower. Not under Eisenhower. They, in effect, were over Eisenhower in terms of the way they used their offices. Kennedy fired Alan Dulles. Then he fired the people under Dulles who were responsible for the Bay of Pigs, Richard Bissell, who was head of covert action, Charles Cabell, who was a general in the Air Force. And incidentally, his brother was mayor of Dallas in November 1963. So Kennedy was then, from that point on, persona non grata to the CIA, and he in turn was deeply suspicious of both the CIA and his major military authorities because they had manipulated and pushed him into a position as president that he rebelled against. So he was rebelling against his chief advisors in intelligence and in the military for the rest of his presidency. It all began at the Bay of Pigs, but it all climaxed in the Cuban Missile Crisis in a remarkable way. The relationship between Kennedy and Khrushchev is an untold story. It lies especially behind his assassination. It's a very complex relationship. They met only one time. It was in Vienna in 1961. Kennedy did achieve some results with Khrushchev at that meeting, but he thought that there was a storm coming. And I use that term because he had a little prayer from Abraham Lincoln that he wrote out on the night when he was going back to Washington from that meeting in a plane. He was falling asleep, and he scribbled on a piece of paper Lincoln's little prayer, I know there is a God, and I see a storm coming. If he has a place for me, I believe that I am ready. And Kennedy saw the storm of nuclear war coming. He saw, and certainly partly, very much partly as a result of his own actions and Khrushchev's and the conflict that was intensifying between them on an ideological basis, absolute something and absolute something else, good versus evil, an ideological conflict that on both sides of capitalism and communism, of the free world and the communist world, as the U.S. put it, that was going to result in a clash that could destroy all of civilization, and for that matter, the world, all of civilization being our way of defining our part of the world. And so Kennedy suggested to Khrushchev at that meeting that maybe they ought to try to communicate informally and beneath the radar of their advisors. And it was a suggestion that Khrushchev took up that fall, and he wrote a secret letter to John F. Kennedy. He sat down in a retreat of his home near the Black Sea, as I recall, and he wrote this letter, very beautifully begun letter, reflecting on the sea and the trees and the shore, and how in this setting he wanted to write to JFK about the hope for peace. He says, "You know, we really ought to recognize that we're on Noah's Ark, you and I are, and all of us." He meant all of us on your side and my side and everybody in between. And he said, "Let's not talk about who the clean and the unclean are on this ark. Let's talk about all of us." And Kennedy received that letter wrapped up in a newspaper, smuggled into his press secretary's office by a KGB, a communist agent. And, of course, Pierre Salinger, the secretary, didn't understand why he was being given a newspaper by a KGB agent for the president of the United States, and he questioned it, and the guy said, "Well, just look inside, give it to the president." Inside was a 20-page secret, informal, personally written letter to John F. Kennedy from Nikita Khrushchev. Their secret correspondence continued for the rest of Kennedy's presidency until he was assassinated. And in that correspondence, they struggled with each other directly, without any intervening people involved, on the key issues of the Cold War. And even when they were at their deepest conflict, and even when the world was on the brink of nuclear war, there was something beneath the surface that went beyond our understanding and even imagination, because they had a relationship through their secret letters. So, how does that affect things? Well, at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when on the 12th day of the 13-day crisis, that was October 28th, Saturday, a U.S. spy plane, the U-2, was shot down over Cuba by a Soviet surface-to-air missile. A terrible moment, one in which the advisors to Kennedy from the National Security Council, certainly the Joint Chiefs, CIA, everybody said, now we have to take out the Soviet missiles. We have to destroy those that they are trying to arm with nuclear warheads. We've got to destroy them in Cuba before they actually are armed with nuclear warheads and before they are capable of striking the United States. And Kennedy refused. He said, "No, I'm not going to do that." And he also understood something that none of his advisors understood, that to do such a thing would take us into a nuclear war. And unknown to him and unknown to all of the people on our side, those nuclear warheads had already been put on the missiles in Cuba. So had the United States tried to take out the Soviet missiles before they were armed, because they had already been armed, we would have had a nuclear war if Kennedy had submitted to those pressures. Instead, he sent Robert Kennedy secretly to Ambassador Anatoly Dobrynin in Washington to issue an appeal to his enemy, Nikita Khrushchev. He said, through RFK to Dobrynin, "I'm losing control. I don't think I can stop this from happening. I need your help." He had reached a point of desperation. His Joint Chiefs especially were already engaged in provocative actions to try to trap the Soviets into giving some sign of going immediately to war so that the U.S. could strike with our overwhelming dominance of nuclear weapons. We had far more nuclear weapons than the Soviets did. And we, namely the Joint Chiefs especially, wanted not only to attack the missile sites on Cuba, they wanted to attack the Soviet Union. They wanted to win the Cold War, which meant, in their terms, taking out 150 million Soviet citizens and losing only 40 million on our side. They wanted to win. So when Kennedy sent this message through his brother to Dobrynin, and Dobrynin wired it to Khrushchev, Khrushchev realized the plight of his enemy, Kennedy, and he turned to his foreign minister, Andrei Gromyko, and he said, "We have to let Kennedy know that we want to help him." Gromyko looked at him as if he had gone crazy, and Khrushchev repeated it aloud, almost to convince himself, I think. He said, "Yes, we have to let Kennedy know that we want to help him. We now have a common cause to save the world from those pushing us toward war." And at that moment, and in the subsequent minutes when Khrushchev went on the radio and the television and said he was withdrawing the Soviet missiles from Cuba, the world of conflict in the Cold War and the adversarial relationship between John F. Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev turned upside down. And each of them, each of these leaders, Kennedy on the one hand and Khrushchev on the other, became closer to each other in their understanding and in their subsequent actions than either of them was to his own national security state. And that had profound implications and consequences for both themselves and the world.
The conquistadors came with their sabers and guns, and they raped and they slaughtered until they were done. They hacked and they killed and left no one alive. Then they brought in the slaves they allowed to survive. "Welcome to the new world," you could hear the men say, as they sat on the shores of Guantanamo Bay. After 400 years, independence was short. That's just how it is with the deep water port. The battleships came and they never left shore. Tasting the conquest, they just wanted more. The sign it said, "Welcome to the U.S. of A." In the Republic of Cuba, Guantanamo Bay. Past the barbed wire in the field of mines, you can see the men who left their families behind. To burn 'neath the sun, to be tortured and killed, where their stomachs are empty and their spirits are grilled. If you're looking for freedom, this is the price you must pay. It's written in blood on Guantanamo Bay. The vultures, they circle at ease overhead. The living may live and the dead will be dead. The time it may come in this tropical heat that they'll have to go somewhere else to eat. Maybe a storm will come wash it away. Still the guard towers glitter on Guantanamo Bay.
Our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures. And we are all mortal. We must conduct our affairs in such a way that it becomes in the communist interest to agree on a genuine peace. And above all, while defending our own vital interests, nuclear powers must avert those confrontations which bring an adversary to a choice of either a humiliating retreat or a nuclear war. Meanwhile, we seek to strengthen the United Nations to help solve its financial problems, to make it a more effective instrument for peace, to develop it into a genuine world security system, a system capable of resolving disputes on the basis of law, of ensuring the security of the large and the small, and of creating conditions under which arms can finally be abolished. It is our hope and the purpose of Allied policy to convince the Soviet Union that she too should let each nation choose its own future, so long as that choice does not interfere with the choices of others. The communist drive to impose their political and economic system on others is the primary cause of world tension today. For there can be no doubt that if all nations could refrain from interfering in the self-determination of others, the peace would be much more assured. This will require a new effort to achieve world law, a new context for world discussions. It will require increased understanding between the Soviets and ourselves. An increased understanding will require increased contact and communication. One step in this direction is the proposed arrangement for a direct line between Moscow and Washington to avoid on each side the dangerous delays, misunderstandings, and misreadings of others' actions which might occur at a time of crisis. We have also been talking in Geneva about our first step measures of arms controls designed to limit the intensity of the arms race and reduce the risk of accidental war. Our primary long-range interest in Geneva, however, is general and complete disarmament, designed to take place by stages, permitting parallel political developments to build the new institutions of peace, which would take the place of arms. The pursuit of disarmament has been an effort of this government since the 1920s. It has been urgently sought by the past three administrations. And however dim the prospects are today, we intend to continue this effort, to continue it in order that all countries, including our own, can better grasp what the problems and the possibilities of disarmament are. The only major area of these negotiations where the end is in sight, yet where a fresh start is badly needed, is in a treaty to outlaw nuclear tests. The conclusion of such a treaty, so near and yet so far, would check the spiraling arms race in one of its most dangerous areas. It would place the nuclear powers in a position to deal more effectively with one of the greatest hazards which man faces in 1963, the further spread of nuclear arms. It would increase our security. It would decrease the prospects of war. Surely this goal is sufficiently important to require our steady pursuit, yielding neither to the temptation to give up the whole effort, nor the temptation to give up our insistence on vital and responsible safeguards. I'm taking this opportunity, therefore, to announce two important decisions in this regard. First, Chairman Khrushchev, Prime Minister McMillan, and I have agreed that high-level discussions will shortly begin in Moscow, looking towards early agreement on a comprehensive test ban treaty. Our hope must be tempered. Our hopes must be tempered with the caution of history, but with our hopes go the hopes of all mankind. Second, to make clear our good faith and solemn convictions on this matter, I now declare that the United States does not propose to conduct nuclear tests in the atmosphere so long as other states do not do so. We will not be the first to resume. Such a declaration is no substitute for a formal binding treaty, but I hope it will help us achieve one. Nor would such a treaty be a substitute for disarmament, but I hope it will help us achieve it. Finally, my fellow Americans, let us examine our attitude towards peace and freedom here at home. the quality and spirit of our own society must justify and support our efforts abroad. We must show it in the dedication of our own lives, as many of you who are graduating today will have an opportunity to do by serving without pay in the Peace Corps abroad or in the proposed National Service Corps here at home. But wherever we are, we must all, in our daily lives, live up to the age-old faith that peace and freedom walk together. In too many of our cities today, the peace is not secure because freedom is incomplete. It is the responsibility of the executive branch at all levels of government, local, state, and national, to provide and protect that freedom for all of our citizens by all means within our authority. It is the responsibility of the legislative branch at all levels, wherever the authority is not now adequate, to make it adequate. And it is the responsibility of all citizens in all sections of this country to respect the rights of others and respect the law of the land. All this. All this is not unrelated to world peace. When a man's way please the Lord, the scriptures tell us, he maketh even his enemies to be at peace with him. And is not peace, in the last analysis, basically a matter of human rights, the right to live out our lives without fear of devastation, the right to breathe air as nature provided it, the right of future generations to a healthy existence? While we proceed to safeguard our national interests, let us also safeguard human interests. And the elimination of war and arms is clearly in the interests of both. No treaty, however much it may be to the advantage of all, however tightly it may be worded, can provide absolute security against the risks of deception and evasion. But it can, if it is sufficiently effective in its enforcement, and it is sufficiently in the interest of its signers, offer far more security and far fewer risks than an unabated, uncontrolled, unpredictable arms race. The United States, as the world knows, will never start a war. We do not want a war. We do not now expect a war. This generation of Americans has already had enough, more than enough, of war and hate and oppression. We shall be prepared if others wish it. We shall be alert to try to stop it. But we shall also do our part to build a world of peace where the weak are safe and the strong are just. We are not helpless before that task, or hopeless of its success. Confident and unafraid, we must labor on, not towards a strategy of annihilation, but towards a strategy of peace.
An astounding speech, and one that reveals the increasing moral idiocy of every president to succeed Kennedy. Thanks for listening. New World Notes comes to you from WWUH-FM at the University of Hartford. Jim Douglas, courtesy of Mind Over Matters. Illegitimi non carborundum, and remember,
we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures, and we are all mortal.